You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 334, Gentiles in the Psalms. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
Well, I from this point forward until, I guess, the summer. Is that right? The summer? Something like that.
The summer.
I will not talk about my fantasy baseball team anymore. I lost by one point, so I'm eliminated now. Mm. And honestly, it ruined my day. But I'm over it.
Well,
you know, thankfully, losing in that league is a familiar experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Thankfully, we got our fantasy talk over with before we started the show. So hopefully we'll spare our audience.
But I just thought I'd make that announcement.
Okay.
The pugs have been eliminated by one lousy point, one tragic managerial error.
That will ruin your
day. There we go.
And also, we got two more announcements. One announcement, Mike, is if you hear snorting, that's Norman in your lap, right?
Yes, Norman is in my lap today because Dreen has been gone almost 2 weeks and he is traumatized.
So
I can't really win. You know, I'm the only one at home. Put him outside the room, he's going to scratch on the door and whine. So usually if I put him on my lap, he's quiet.
Not me or Mike snorting, if you hear that. Weird noise. And then our second announcement, Mike, is it's about that time for a new book study. And so we're going to have for our audience to vote.
You want me to list them or do you want to list them? I should probably list them, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. So there's Jude. Right. That's one.
Correct.
Jonah. And then the third thing, this is the reason why I'm really the person to list these, is the Old Testament in the book of Revelation. Now, the reason I need to say this is because I need to qualify it. We're not doing a book study of Revelation as far as doing end times speculation and end time systems. This is exactly what it sounds like. The Old Testament in the book of Revelation. So, you know, kind of the stuff we've been doing. But tracking through the whole book of Revelation for it. So there you go.
That'd be interesting. Connecting the Old Testament to the book of Revelation.
Yeah, other than Matthew, I think it's really fair to say that Revelation is the book that uses the Old Testament the most. It's kind of hard to pick, I guess, but there's a lot in it. Mm.
So if there's any way for us or me to push the voting in one direction, I wish I could, but I won't. But hopefully people are picking up what we're putting down here and we'll vote accordingly because that sounds interesting to me. This is probably the most we're going to get of Revelation from you. I mean, you've done some stuff here and there, but never this thorough with the Old Testament to Revelation. And it's not prophecy stuff. It's none of that.
Right.
So
it's the closest I'll ever get to that, but it isn't that.
It's kind of like already, but not yet. It's that, but not that. That could be our new one.
There you go. There you go.
That,
so you're already ready for the whole series.
That's perfect.
You're already tuned in.
Yeah, that's perfect. I've already chalked it up as a win. No, so voting starts now. So as you hear this podcast, voting is officially opened up, and it's going to run for the next 4 weeks. And the poll is going to close October 31st on Halloween.
There you go.
Halloween.
How fitting.
The poll is going to close and Revelation is going to open. Ooh, no.
Right.
No.
We could do a Stranger Things and point here and say the gate is going to close on Halloween. How's that?
And the ninth gate opens. Have you seen that movie, The Ninth Gate, with Johnny Depp?
No.
Oh, you got to watch.
No, I haven't.
He's a book collector or an agent or something.
Really?
That sells books. Yeah, and it's all about satanic books. And one book was written by the devil and how to open the ninth gate to get eternal.
I wonder if the devil uses the Oxford comma or not.
I need to. Yeah, I need to go back and.
I'm interested in it just for that reason. So, what side is the devil on that?
Yeah.
That debate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you need to watch. If you do, report back and let us know your thoughts on it. So, all right. So good. So once again, voting starts now. Runs the whole month of October. And it ends Halloween at midnight. Ooh, let's make it midnight. Perfect. And November we'll start our new book study.
Yep, sounds good.
All right. All right. Looking forward to that. All right, Mike. Well, this week we're going to the Psalms. Gentiles. I'm in the Psalms, huh?
Right. Gentiles in the Psalms. I mean, we might as well just jump right into it. You know, this is gonna feel a little bit familiar, you know, to the kinds of things we've been doing because we've, you know, been talking about the Old Testament a lot, but linking it to the New. This one's got a more conceptual or peripheral link. Conceptual is probably a better word there, in that you're already going to sort of know, and I'm going to remind you in at least one instance specifically, but this is going to be more general, that the New Testament writers are going to hook into these Psalms, you know, just generally because they're about Gentile inclusion in the people of God. So we're going to be leaving Ezekiel specifically and, you know, specific connections with the Gospels or any other specific New Testament book. Today, I want to take a bit of a broader look, just sort of a topical episode, but it's going to still have this sort of linkage. And when, how can I put it this? I'll put it this way. Gentiles in the Psalms, specifically, we're going to narrow that a little bit. We're going to talk about the Zion hymns of the Psalms, because this whole notion of Zion, again, being the ultimate home of God, the ultimate abode of God, this is where God's family is ultimately going to live, and that family is going to include Gentiles. So there are certain types of Psalms, notably these Zion hymns, that's the term scholars use, and they're going to be oriented to Gentile inclusion. So part of the reason I'm doing this is I think it's kind of a myth that the Old Testament doesn't have an interest in Gentiles being in the family of God. That really isn't the case. And, you know, there are different places you can go in the Old Testament and find that. So today I want to just point out one that I think is just generally missed. And the source I'm going to sort of use as a springboard today actually makes the same comment, that this is kind of a neglected area of inquiry, really an area of focus. It's he hasn't found a whole lot on this. And the source is an article, and this is freely available online, so you can just type in the name of the article with the author, and you're going to be able to get a PDF of this. It's Robert D. Miller, and the article is entitled The Gentiles in the Zion Hymns. And then there's a subtitle, Canaanite Myth and Christian Mission. And it's from the journal named Transformation, which is an international journal of holistic mission studies. Volume 26, number 4, 2009. Robert D. Miller specifically, is a Roman Catholic, and he tells you that in the article. And he teaches at the Catholic University of America. He's an Old Testament scholar, and he focuses a lot on, you know, Israelite religion and, you know, obviously, you know, not just the Psalms, but the Psalms are part of that. I'm going to read you the abstract here so you can get an idea of where he's going in this article and where we're going to go today. So he writes this: the Psalms are an underused resource as a biblical basis for mission, especially since the Gentiles are treated more positively in the Psalms than in most of the rest of the Old Testament. In the Psalms, the inclusion of the Gentiles in the community of God focuses on their coming to Zion. This article explores what that means in the context of Israelite religion and the Canaanite images it borrowed. Hermeneutical conclusions are drawn from this and the history of interpretation of these Psalms in order to enrich the theology of mission. So this journal, that's the end of the abstract, this journal is a journal for missions work, missions scholarship. And Miller, again, is contributing to it with this specific, you know, point that, hey, you know, the Old Testament, you know, does have these things in them about Gentile inclusion. And, you know, due to his work on the Psalms and in other areas, he has run across this. And so he's going to share a few specifics about Zion Psalms to make that point. Now, in his initial paragraph, he adds these thoughts. Again, this will give you a little more of the flavoring. References, again, in these Psalms, to inclusion of Gentiles into the community of God are more abundant in the Psalter than anywhere else in the Old Testament. The Psalms have been largely absent in treatments of mission in the Bible. Completely missing, for example, in Christopher Wright's essay, The Old Testament and Christian Mission, which I believe is a book. This presentation examines the theme of the Gentiles in the Psalter, concentrating on the Psalms that are called Zion hymns. While these constitute a rather minor portion of the Psalter, they are an important group for understanding the attitude towards non-Israelites. And this here's an interesting sentence a little later down. I will show that the Psalms predict an eschatological inclusion of the Gentiles, or realize that inclusion now in anticipation, and Israel is the agent of that inclusion without evangelistic activity. What he means by that last line is that you don't, in the Old Testament, you don't see Israelites portrayed as evangelists. You know, I'll use a term from, you know, old line evangelicalism, as soul winners. Okay, they don't go out and knock on doors and hold evangelistic campaigns. You don't see that in the Old Testament, but you do see Israel and the nations in other activities designed to attract Gentiles into the family of God. If you're already thinking, you know, the Exodus 19, you know, 5, the whole, I think 5 and 6, the whole, you know, kingdom of priests idea, again, you're tracking already. And those kinds of themes are going to come up as we discuss these Psalms. So if you're in your head, if you're that far, again, you already, you know, are sort of oriented to today's episode. Now, what Miller does in this article is he first describes what a Zion hymn or a Zion, you know, psalm, more appropriately, a Zion hymn is. In psalm study, psalms break down into different categories. You have different types of psalms, different genres, okay? Hymns is one of them, but you have maybe kingship psalms or enthronement psalms. You have worship psalms. You have lament psalms, both individually and corporate. I mean, there are different genres of psalms. And so the hymn psalm is one of these that everybody who has studied the Psalms formally runs into. And so Miller says the elements of a Zion hymn are the same as a normal hymn psalm. There's a call to praise. There's a recounting of God's deeds, you know, things that God has done, and then there's a conclusion. And Miller adds, because of this sameness, there's a debate as to just which psalms are Zion hymns as opposed to just, you know, normal hymns. Now, in that regard, in this article, Miller argues, he points out, you know, demonstrates that Zion hymns are characterized that way, not by specific structural elements, because they're the same as all the other hymn psalms in terms of the elements they have. Rather, they get characterized this way by points of content, not structure, but content. So he writes this: there are five features of content that distinguish the Zion hymns from other hymns. First is the identification of Mount Zion with the mythical highest mountain in the utmost north, you know, the heights of the north, equated with Mount Zaphon of Canaanite mythology. And this is very familiar to readers of Unseen Realm. Miller says this is evident in Psalm 48:2, Mount Zion, the heights of Zaphon, the city of the great king. And that, you know, that kind of language occurs in Psalm 89:13 and elsewhere, you know, Isaiah 14:13, for instance. Second, there are streams of paradise or some kind of, you know, water element that flow from the cosmic mountain, okay, flow from Mount Zion, the cosmic mountain. And he cites here Psalm 87:7, Psalm 46:4. There is a quote, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. Third, this is the location of Yahweh's primordial victory over the sea of chaos. Again, this is a familiar element, again, for readers of Unseen Realm. And, you know, Miller will cite a few psalms where this shows up. For instance, Psalm 46:3-4, the sea through the waters thereof roar and be troubled, or though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. Again, Yahweh is going to have the victory. Fourth, God also defeats the nations of the earth in these Zion hymns. He defeats the nations of the earth specifically from his cosmic mountain or at his cosmic mountain in a great battle at dawn. Now, I mentioned the at dawn because Miller's going to make something of that point a little bit later. And he uses an example here in Psalm 45, 6, and 7. This victory, again, that he has over the nations was accomplished both through theophany, again, an appearance of God, and through God's word of reproach, you know, something God says. And then fifthly, the fifth element, and he says, Miller says, this is the most important for our purposes, is where the Gentile nations make pilgrimage to Zion to worship Yahweh. And the example here he gives is Psalm 68, 28, and 29, and Psalm 86, 9. Now, Psalm 68 ought to be really familiar, again, to those who not only have read Unseen Realm, but just in general discussion, because this is the psalm, Psalm 68, that mentions Hermon. This is the one that Paul is going to quote in Ephesians 4, the whole, you know, leading captivity captive passage. This is the psalm that he quotes. And when Paul does it, you know, he's the apostle to the Gentiles. He's naturally going to link this to the plan of salvation that involves Gentile inclusion. And it's the, you know, it's in Ephesians 4, it's the passage about ascending and descending, which is connected to Pentecost. Again, there you go with the whole notion of Jews coming to Pentecost, Jews from all over the world in all these nations coming to Pentecost, believing, then going home, and they plant the seeds of the gospel in all these places that Paul will eventually plant churches. So Psalm 68 is a pretty important psalm, and in what Miller does in this article is he spends a decent amount of time in Psalm 68, and so we will as well. So Miller goes on, and he further notes that Zion hymns will not necessarily have all of those content elements, but they will have some of them. And he also notes that, quote, four of the five features just outlined are specifically drawn from Canaanite mythology, you know, Canaanite religion. And Mount Zaphon is the first one he discusses. Again, very familiar territory for those who have read Unseen Realm, but I'll share a little bit of what he writes here. Miller writes, in Canaanite mythology, it is Mount Zaphon is the home of Baal. And then he gives you the Canaanite text citations, KTU, whatever. I'm not going to read those. But he says, thus, in the Baal epic, the mountain is called the sacred mountain, the cosmic Zaphon. Baal on the peaks of Zaphon, Baal on the heights of Zaphon. These are all descriptive phrases. And my mountain, the divine Zaphon, the mountain of possession. The rivers of paradise are there. They signify the residence of the high god El, called the midst of the headwaters of the two oceans. The victory of Baal over the chaos sea, Yam, is well known. It is after his defeat of the sea that Baal receives his temple on Zaphon, and in the hands of Zaphon are victory and triumph. In some texts, this victory occurs at dawn, and there's the dawn element again. This victory ending all war. It ends all war because Baal is made king of the gods and king of the nations. So this victory ending all war is reflected in, you know, various texts where the victory over chaos will, quote, banish war from the earth. So this is the first point he, you know, Miller highlights the whole Zaphon mindset, you know, that part of their worldview. And he discusses a little bit more, and then he makes an important observation. And I wanted to include this. You know, I don't know if I'd word this exactly the way he does, but, you know, he explains himself, so, you know, maybe I could live with it. He says, Israel borrowed these motifs from the Canaanites. Okay, the word borrow is the one I don't like, but he backs away from it. In a moment, I'll read this. Israel borrowed these motifs from the Canaanites. The social location of the biblical writers necessitated them contrasting their faith with the Canaanites. What is clearly missing in the Canaanite mythology is the pilgrimage of the nations. The Israelites added this piece for their own accord. And he notes this. This I think is pretty profound. I thus far have not found any ancient Near Eastern antecedent for this. And this highlights its importance for the theological message of the Psalms. That's the end of Miller's quote. So basically he's saying, look, the Israelites use this stuff specifically because their circumstances, he calls it their social location, their circumstances really required, it necessitated them to do things like this to draw a contrast between their God, their, you know, worldview, their faith, with that of the Canaanites. And one of the chief contrasts, Miller says, is this point where, you know, in the Baal epic, you have just Baal just, you know, being overlord of all the nations, you know, and it's an end of warfare, but Baal does this not through any sort of loving solicitation or, you know, providential solicitation. It's a conquest idea. You know, Baal is, he's the conqueror. He's victorious. Baal is one of the main epithets of Baal, Alion Baal in Canaanite literature. But in the Psalms, okay, you have this notion that the Gentiles, the nations themselves, are moved to seek out the true God. Again, they come, they make a pilgrimage to worship the Lord. And what Miller's saying is that just isn't anywhere else except the Hebrew Bible. You don't find that idea where a people of other gods are seeking out, you know, the Most High or the true God. You don't find that anywhere else. That's Hebrew Bible stuff. Now, from this point on, he focuses his discussion on Psalm 68, 86, and 87. So three Psalms. And if you get the article, you can look at his whole discussion of these things. But he spends a lot of time really in Psalm 68. And again, that is where Mount, you know, I said Mount Hermon, but it's Mount, the mountain of Bashan, which is, there's only one mountain there. It's Hermon. And Bashan, you know, Mount Bashan, Hermon is a rival to Sinai in Psalm 68. And you have the psalmist, you know, let me just go to Psalm 68. We might as well read part of it. Let's go to Psalm 68. And I'll start with, let's see, verse 15. Okay, so Psalm 68:15. O mountain of God, mountain of Bashan, O many-peaked mountain, mountain of Bashan, why do you look with hatred, O many-peaked mountain, at the mount that God desired for his abode? In other words, Sinai. Yes, where the Lord will dwell forever. It's either Sinai or Zion. I mean, he's going to mention Sinai in the next, you know, couple verses from this point. The chariots of God are twice 10,000, thousands upon thousands. The Lord is among them. Sinai is now in the sanctuary. I mean, you could still see this as Zion, and the notion that Sinai is now in the sanctuary could be a reference to the Ark. You know, we've talked before about how, you know, the Ark and the tablets, the stone and the rock and all that kind of stuff. It's just a few episodes ago about, again, Old Testament language in certain New Testament books, how the tablets were sort of like a piece of Sinai that traveled with the Israelites. It was Sinai, but wasn't, and all that. That kind of thinking, that could be behind this, that the Ark is now in the sanctuary. But again, it could be either one. Either we're talking about Zion and then Sinai's in the sanctuary. Maybe we're just talking about Sinai. You could translate it maybe on, you know, the sanctuary or something like that, or at the sanctuary. But continuing in verse 18, it says, you ascended on high, leading a host of captives in your train and receiving gifts among men, even among the rebellious, that the Lord God may dwell there. Of course, that's the part that Paul quotes. So this is Psalm 68. Again, this is where he's going to spend most of his time. You know, if you keep reading, that was verses 15 through 18. You know, listen to some of the language here. Let's see here. If we read Miller, let's see where Miller sort of focuses here. Let's read down to verse 22. Blessed be the Lord who daily bears us up. God is our salvation. Our God is a God of salvation, and to God, the Lord, belong deliverances from death. But God will strike the heads of his enemies, the hairy crown of him who walks in his guilty ways. The Lord said, I will bring them back from Bashan. I will bring them back from the depths of the sea. Again, sea being obviously a chaos, you know, token there. But who's he bringing back? Well, he's not bringing the Israelites back, you know, from Bashan. He would be bringing back the people of Bashan. He's bringing them back where? Well, to himself. I'm going to bring them back from the depths of the sea. You keep going down to, you get verse 24. There's a procession. Your procession is seen, O God, the procession of my God, my King, into the sanctuary again. Then there's the singers and the musicians and so on and so forth. You know, you get this notion that you have a train, you know, like, you know, a train of people. you know, a procession, you know, leading, you know, to where, leading up to where the presence of God is. And so you get this description in the psalm, and then you hit verse 31. Nobles shall come, you know, as part of this procession from Egypt, Cush in Ethiopia or the Sudan, you know, but Cush shall hasten to stretch out her hands to God. Okay, O kingdoms of the earth, sing to God, sing praises to the Lord, Selah, to him who rides in the heavens, the ancient heavens. Behold, he sends out his voice, his mighty voice, so on and so forth. We'll get to other parts of it. But again, you have this procession that includes Gentiles. So Miller discusses this. He draws attention to that last phrase, which again is going to be familiar to Unseen Realm readers, to him who rides in the heavens. All right. It's the rider on the clouds thing. This is one of the places where rider on the clouds language occurs. Again, used of Yahweh, it's five times total, used of Yahweh four times, and the fifth is the outlier. It's in Daniel 7. And Miller goes on to discuss Daniel 7 because there's a relationship between Daniel 7 and the Gentiles, because the Son of Man, in that case, that's the one who rides on the clouds. That's the one who gets the deity epithet of Baal, not the Ancient of Days, who's also in the scene, but different than the Son of Man. This, in this case, the Son of Man is the deity figure as well. There's two deity figures. That's the importance of Daniel 7. But it includes the Gentiles because unto the Son of Man is giving everlasting kingship, you know, of all the nations. So there's a direct connection here between the whole Zion thinking when it comes to the Gentiles being part of the family and part of the kingdom of God in Daniel 7 and then back to Psalm 68. Miller then has a few things to say about Psalm 86. He writes, Psalm 86 is a prayer set in the context of David's thanksgiving uttered after the prophecy of Nathan. Let me just stop there. Remember David sins, you know, with Bathsheba. And, you know, Nathan, of course, the prophet, comes to him and gives him this little allegory, and so on and so forth, you know, and thou art the man, and, you know, you're guilty, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's the setting, the confrontation there in the wake of David's sin is the setting for this psalm. And so Miller wants to point that out because certain parts of Psalm 86 are going to indicate that David's in some kind of crisis and, you know, is praying, you know, needing forgiveness and all this sort of stuff. Let me just read that sentence again. Psalm 86 is a prayer set in the context of David's thanksgiving uttered after the prophecy of Nathan, you know, that God isn't going to kill David, remove the throne and all that. Jürgen Vondran has shown how it clearly, Psalm 86, clearly draws on the canonical book of Isaiah with language taken from Isaiah 2, Isaiah 7, Isaiah 25, Isaiah 51, and Isaiah 66. Verses 8 and 10 suggest this is a prediction of future events. Let me just read Psalm 86, and I'll read verses 8 through 13. There is none like you among the gods, O Lord. Okay, again, this isn't Psalm 82 or Psalm 89, Psalm 86. There's none like you among the gods, O Lord, nor are there any works like yours. All the nations you have made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and shall glorify your name, for you are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God. Teach me your way, O Lord, that I may walk in your truth. Unite my heart to fear your name. I will give thanks to you, O Lord my God, with my whole heart, and I will glorify your name forever. For great is your steadfast love toward me. You have delivered my soul from the depths of Sheol. So, you know, again, Miller's observation is that, you know, there are parts of this that are sort of now, and then there are parts that sort of look forward, you know, to something that's going to happen here. The covenant's going to be preserved. You know, the Davidic covenant is intact. And God's goals that extend from that covenant are thus preserved as well. You know, things are going to work out the way the Lord wants them to work out. Now, this leads to, in Miller's article, the question of why did the biblical writers include this pilgrimage idea? Again, he said it's unique. He said it's unique in this sort of, you know, kingship kind of language, especially Canaanite stuff. Why do it? And Miller writes again something, you know, interesting here, I think is really, that's really worth pointing out. He says, Israel was faced, just think about this, Israel was faced with the paradox that to ever grant the Gentiles equality with Israel before Yahweh would negate Israel's election, while to allow no future acknowledgement of God on the part of the Gentiles would put into question the universality of God. Let me just stop there. I mean, it's very evident that Israel is elect. Israel was started from nothing, you know, Abraham and Sarah, but, you know, God had to enable her to have children right after the disinheritance at Babel. So they have a supernatural point of origin. And by definition, that means they're chosen. But in the covenant with the chosen, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. I mean, there's this, you know, quote unquote universal. This isn't universalism like theologians would talk about. When Old Testament scholars typically talk about universalism in the Old Testament, it means inclusion of the Gentiles. Okay. So, you know, again, there's a paradox here. Well, how could a Jew, how could an Israelite ever grant that the Gentiles, you know, had the same standing before God? But if they deny that, well, then they kind of deny the whole point of this covenant too. You know, so Miller's pointing out that there's a bit of a quandary here. And he continues, he says, the solution of the Psalter is never subjugation of the nations by Israel, but either to predict an eschatological acknowledgement of them, and he cites Psalm 72 and Psalm 102, or to realize that acknowledgement now, like to realize, you know, go ahead and acknowledge it now in anticipation of the eschatological fulfillment. And here he cites Psalm 66. Israel is never portrayed as acting to bring this about. In other words, they're not doing evangelistic meetings, okay? The burden, Miller writes, is entirely on God, who is the only missionary in the Old Testament. However, Israel is nevertheless the instrument of the nation's inclusion. Israel is a community of actors. He's quoting somebody else here. Israel is a community of actors who embody what God has in mind for all. This is me breaking in. In other words, the kingdom of priests idea. Miller continues, God will draw the nations to himself by drawing them to Israel, and in particular to Zion. In all the places where the nations come to Israel, it is to Zion. Zion is the locus of salvation for all nations, just as Abraham had been. Psalm 87, and he cross-references Zechariah 8, 21 through 23, envisions Zion as the reverse of the Tower of Babel. Okay, that's not Mike talking there. That's another you know, Old Testament scholar. So again, I'm not making this up, but when you read it in Unseen Realm or hear it, Zion is the reverse of the Tower of Babel. Israel is the mediator of this action of God, although not evangelistic in the Old Testament again. Israel's mission also both the witness, it witnesses to what God wants. It's both the witness and the evidence of Yahweh to the nations, of Yahweh's intent to the nations. Israel is a herald of Yahweh by guarding the true faith and by rehearsing Yahweh's praises, not to the nations, but in the presence of the nations. And he cites a bunch of passages here, Psalm 47, 2-3, 65, 3, 67, 5, 100, verse 1, so on. Israel, this is his last line, Israel is exhibit A in evidence for the loving nature of God, Psalm 117, 1. So I think that's really a significant paragraph that orients the Zion Psalms here. You know, Israel, I mean, put yourself in their situation, Old Testament Israel. It's Israel against the nations. It's Yahweh against the gods. Again, we know the worldview that emerges from the Babel event. But we also know, you know, we know about Israel's election, but we also know that God has made a covenant with his elect, okay, that somebody from the elect, you know, Israel, is going to result in the inclusion, the re-inclusion, the reversal of Babel. It's going to result in the re-inclusion of the nations. So Israel sort of has to affirm both things. And the strategy for that isn't, again, being carriers of the Great Commission or evangelism like we think of it, you know, in a post, you know, Jesus context or Book of Acts context. Rather, it's to be something that attracts the nations. You know? It is to, yes, again, Israel is a herald, but telling and modeling, this is probably the easiest way to summarize what Miller just wrote. Israel does tell. Israel does have conversations, you know, about her God with others. But they more or less serve to model what life is like in Yahweh's family, or what it should be like. And that should attract the nations. Again, we talk about this a lot, you know, in on the podcast, you know, it's a theme in Unseen Realm, but again, the Zion hymns, there it is. Okay, there it is. You know, they're this model, they're this point of attraction, you know, for what God wants. And I just thought, you know, for today, you know, I thought it's nice to have another scholar, you know, affirm this. Now, what he does from this point on is he goes to Psalm 87, which is a summoning of nations to Zion. I'm going to reference Golden Gay here, using his Psalms commentary for this point. I kind of like his translation here, Psalm 87, 4 through 6. Golden Gay's way of characterizing the psalm, instead of summoning of the nations to Zion, he has the heading, the nations as citizens of Zion, which I think is a nice turn of phrase there for what we're talking about. And again, he has the passage, you know, this way, or I think this might be the JPS translation. I don't know if it's his own or not, but I'm going to read it to you because I thought it did a good job. I mention Egypt. This is Psalm 87, 4 through 6. I mention Egypt and Babylon among those who know me. Philistia too, and Tyre with Ethiopia and Cush. Each was born there. Indeed, it shall be said of Zion, every man was born in it. For the Most High himself will establish it. The Lord records as he registers the peoples, this one was born there. Now, boy, that is pregnant with theology, as I like to say. You know, just those few verses. Again, if you have the Deuteronomy 32 worldview in your head, which ancient Israelite biblical writers did, there's just a lot of theology in there. There's a truckload in there. And Golden Gay, you know, summarizes points of it, and so does Miller. So I'm gonna read something from Golden Gay first here. He writes this in his commentary on the psalm. The first object of this naming is Rahab in the text. Now he has, or the JPS, I think it is, the translation has Egypt. We'll explain that, because in other passages, Egypt is termed Rahab. This is one of the chaos, you know, monsters, okay? But let me just pick up with what Golden Gay says. The first object of this naming is Rahab, which is one of the names for a sea monster who embodied and symbolized dynamic powers asserted against God. Egypt can be thought of as its incarnation. Again, at times at least, Psalm 89, 10, 10 and 11, Job 9, 3, or 9, 13, excuse me, Job 26, 12, Isaiah 37. The big one is Isaiah 51, 9, because that specifically links Egypt into this. Golden Gay says, it can thus be a rather solemn designation, or it can be used to make fun of Egypt as lacking the dynamic power it pretended to have. Pairing with the old enemy to the south, Egypt, is Babylon, as the great oppressor to the north. So Egypt and Babylon in Psalm 87, that's north and south. Philistia and Tyre were then among the peoples conspiring, you know, elsewhere in Psalm 83, 5 through 8. So the first four peoples in this psalm, Psalm 87, might suggest a roster of enemy nations, Golden Gay says, that has now become a unity of citizenship within Zion. But Sudan, Cush, Ethiopia, is then a slightly odd addition to the list, which makes it questionable whether there is a single rationale for mentioning these peoples. I mean, if it, if, let me just stop there. If it was just those four, it's like, again, the four quadrants here, you know, you could come up with some sort of, you know, logic here. But, you know, honestly, Tyre is north, just like Babylon is, and Philistia is to the west. What about the east? You know, I mean, Golden Gate saying it's probably not, the logic here is probably not like the four cardinal points or anything like that. So back to Golden Gate. He says, you know, including, you know, Sudan or Kush or Ethiopia is a slightly odd addition to the list, which makes it questionable whether there's a single rationale for mentioning these peoples. They are not actually a coherent collection of traditional enemies, nor do they represent the points of the compass, nor do they especially point to one historical period. And the description of Egypt as Rahab or Rahab suggests that the psalm has other agendas than merely listing enemies. But all of these nations feature in the prophecies about foreign nations, the oracles against the nations in the prophets, which characteristically speak of calamity to come on them, though they also usually include some elements of hope for these peoples. This, the hope aspect, is the aspect the psalm will take up. So this psalm essentially collects some of the main objects of wrath in the oracles against the nations. And now, I mean, just let's go back and read it again. Here's what the psalm says about them. I mention Egypt and Babylon among those who know me. This is God speaking. Philistia too, and Tyre with Ethiopia. Each was born there. Okay, you know, it's not talking about each individual person, each individual nation. The there in the context is Zion. Okay, each was born there. Indeed, it shall be said of Zion, every man was born in it. For the Most High himself will establish it. The Lord records, as he registers the peoples, plural, this one was born there. Again, it lumps them all into the family of Zion. You know, Miller writes of this passage. Let me add a thought from Miller. He says, the list of nations moves from large evil empires to smaller neighboring enemies, you know, Philistia and Tyre, and then ends with the alien and distant Ethiopia. They mark, again, you know, they're basically surrounding enemies, with Zion, you know, sort of the center point, even though they're not, you know, specific cardinal points and all that. So he thinks it's big and small. You know, large and small, the enemies of God, the enemies of Yahweh and his people are going to be included in the family. You know, Golden Gate elsewhere in his commentary has this observation. He says, the psalm is indicating that nations such as Egypt and Babylon will come to be counted as people who were born in Jerusalem. A novel image. The use of the verb, okay, this is the interesting point to me. The use of the verb fits that of Psalm 2:7. Okay, remember Psalm 2:7 where Yahweh says to the king, you are my son. Today I have begotten you or fathered you. The verb is yalad. Okay, it's the same verb in this psalm. The declaration, Golden Gate writes, is one whereby a man makes someone his son. Adoption is spoken of as fathering. Again, if you go back to Psalm 2, God is speaking to the king. Well, the king is already in existence. The king is already, you know, born, okay? And so, you know, today I have made you my son. Today I have yalad you. I have made you my son. So what Golden Gate is saying is, you know, let's take the language back to Psalm 87. Okay, if the language is that whereby a man makes someone his son, in a similar way, Yahweh declares that each of these nations has been fathered or adopted in Jerusalem so that they become the city's true citizens. Again, it's really unexpected. I mean, this is something, again, if you're an Israelite, you're a Jew, reading this in a psalm of the nations. I mean, this is, you know, honestly, you know, we've talked before, like, for instance, about Jesus' sermon at Nazareth, where he eliminates the judgment language against the Gentiles from Isaiah 61 and Isaiah 58. And he does it, you know, half a dozen other places too. specifically to highlight, you know, and it's Luke, you know, Luke's writing, he is a Gentile, he's writing to Gentile, a Gentile friend. Okay. Specifically to make the point of Gentile inclusion. And this is one of the factors that offends people in the synagogue at Nazareth as to what he's saying. It isn't just the fact that he says today this is fulfilled in your own, you know, hearing. Okay, well, that's audacious enough. But they don't want to hear that not only are we in exile and in need of atonement, but so are the Gentiles, and we're all going to be benefactors of the atonement that this guy says he's bringing, but ultimately that God's going to bring. I mean, that they didn't want to hear that. It's not, you know, high on the list of things that are going to comfort them. They want revenge. They want liberation, and they want revenge. And that isn't what they're getting. Now, I also think, you know, one other thing here, or a couple, you know, we're not at the very end here, but we're getting close to where I want to wrap this up. I think the language in verse 5 in Psalm 87 is interesting, too. It doesn't have Yahweh doing this. It has the Most High. Okay, go back, you know, to Psalm 87, 5. Indeed, it shall be said of Zion, every man was born in it. You know, regardless of you know, whether you're from Abraham or somebody else, everyone was born in it. You know, if you're here, you belong here, okay? For the Most High himself will establish it. Again, this is language that goes back to Deuteronomy 32. You see it in Psalm 82. Again, it's a way of signaling the Babel reversal. And again, Miller points this out. Other commentators have pointed it out. It's not just me. Now, as far as some New Testament connections, you know, we want to do a little bit of this. As, you know, this is, I want this to fit sort of in what we've been doing, even though we're oriented, in this case, to the Psalms of the Old Testament. Just a few. I mean, there, in the course of his article, Miller brings out, you know, some New Testament scholarship on this. So he writes, in the New Testament, quoting Richard Bauckham, the Zion theology becomes an exclusively theological kind of geography, an interesting way of putting it. The imagery thus underlies Matthew 8:11's statement. Now catch this. Bauckham is saying, you know, what's going on here in Psalm 87, where, you know, now you get the Gentiles, these nations being, you know, part of Zion, okay? This theological geography going on. He says this: the imagery underlies Matthew 8:11 and 12 statement that, quote, many will come from east and west and sit with Abraham. It's just an interesting way to apply it. Miller continues. He says others have found the Zion Gentile thinking central to Paul's theology. Well, that's an understatement. Arthur Glasser holds that Paul sees Jesus and the kingdom of God standing in the position of Zion. The image of Galatians 4:26 of the, quote, Jerusalem, which is above, is free and is our mother. This is Paul writing to Gentiles. Builds on Psalm 87, 1 through 4. In Psalm 68, we have, among the gods there is none to compare with you. That's echoed in Paul's speech to the Areopagus in Acts 17. And it is. Again, it's an allusion to the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. And then, of course, the obvious one is Ephesians 4:8, using Psalm 68's language of Yahweh ascending to Zion after a victory and receiving gifts to describe Jesus' ascension later, again by Paul. So Miller writes, the consummation of these images in the New Testament is in Revelation. In chapter 21's vision of a redeemed Jerusalem, the seven-headed dragon, already having been defeated in chapter 12, okay, Psalms 86:9 is quoted again in the hymn of Moses and the Lamb in Revelation 15:3-4. So, I mean, basically, he's looking at Revelation 21, the healing of the nations. Again, he's looking in Revelation 15:3-4. All the nations will come and adore you for the many acts of saving justice you have shown. You know, Miller cites the rivers of paradise flowing from the holy mountain in Revelation 22, the new Jerusalem of Revelation 21. Where, of course, there is no more sea. There's no more chaos. And there's a lot in this article. So I recommend it to listeners. It's freely available online. Again, it is a scholarly article, but I think most of you, you know, can handle it just fine, especially since you're used to the subject matter from Unseen Realm. And I want you to remember the content of this, even if you don't go get the article and read through it. I want you to remember the content of this episode. The next time you hear someone say the Deuteronomy 32 worldview is something Mike made up, he made it up in Unseen Realm. Or that there's no concept in the Old Testament of Gentile inclusion. Wrong and wrong, okay? So for our context, to close this episode, I do want to add one more thing Miller says in his last paragraph that I think is relevant to our own cultural chaos. You know, I recently had a conversation, or maybe it was an interview, I can't remember, about what current events mean for believers. You know, I'm getting this question a lot now. How should believers, you know, think about the times in which we live? You know, and you know, sometimes people want to steer it to, you know, are we in the end times? You know, that kind of thing. But my answer is basically going to be the same in any regard. My answer to how we should respond to the times in which we live is do your job and leave the rest to the Lord. You know, to me, it's that simple. It's his job to steer things to the time of his return. It isn't mine. Okay, it's not our job to obsess about, you know, the timing and are we at this point or that point or what. You know, typically when believers get into this, when they're absorbed by it, they typically don't respond with rejoicing like, this is awesome. You know, the Lord's going to come back soon. I can hardly wait. This is awesome. Instead, when they get into this kind of speculation, they respond with fear. Like they're waiting for the next shoe to drop. Like if you really believe the Lord is coming back soon, why are you so interested in preserving your own life and your lifestyle? I don't get it. That's a disconnect. You know, end time speculation basically paralyzes the church, or at best impedes it from doing its job. And again, this, do your job, let God do his job. Okay. So Miller writes this again, his article is about, again, Zion hymns and Gentile inclusion and the mission plan of the Old Testament for all this. So here's what Miller writes. He says, but to be a model society as Israel was in the Old Testament, the church cannot remain within the task that modern society has assigned it. A religious subsystem that is supposed to see to it that a somewhat more festive brilliance lights up the margins of banal daily life, as Norbert Lofink puts it. This is who Miller's quoting. It is, he continues, Lofink continues, a new society, not a better counterpart, but opposite society. It is the vision of peace of Psalm 46, Psalm 72, 6 and 7, Psalm 76, verse 2. God's new society is created by all together. More precisely, it is created by the one Spirit who is pouring out over all and each. That is just what makes this society unique. And that's how Miller ends his article. Let me just summarize the point I think he's making there. The church needs to sort of recapture the vision, not of being a better version of the world and world society, but something different, something unique. Israel was a kingdom of priests. They weren't just better Canaanites, right? We need to just think about that. We need to mimic that and mime it. And that's really what he's getting at here. You know, we need to model this and think about what he's saying. Again, that I think is a great point to end on. And so I wanted to share that with you before, as we wrap up here.
All right, Mike, another good one. Do you have any idea what dots we're going to connect next week?
No, it's kind of like last week. You know, I have kind of a bucket full of these, and whichever one sort of hits me as far as good timing. So, you know, we're just going to, you know, continue in this kind of trend.
Perfect. All right. I just want to remind everybody, please go vote. You go to the nakedbiblepodcast.com website to vote on the next Bible study. Again, it's going to run for the next 4 weeks, so go cast your vote, and I'm excited to see what everybody decides on, Mike, and looking forward to it.
Yeah, be interesting.
Well, with that, I want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com.
To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.